From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Many of us were taught to feel good when we recycle. When we put that plastic bottle into the recycling container, we feel pleased at the thought of it being turned into something new instead of creating more trash. Still, if recycling's not easy, many people won't do it. And so about 30 years ago, communities began adopting a new approach called fully commingled or single-stream recycling. No more fussing around with glass versus cans. Just toss it all in the same bin and feel your self-esteem rise. But now a combination of forces has turned this eco-friendly dream into a nightmare. And today in The Exchange, we find out what's driving this and how communities are reassessing their recycling. Let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests in studio. Michael Nork is here, analyst for the Solid Waste Management Bureau of the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Michael, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Mike Durfor, Executive Director of the Northeast Resource Recovery Association, a nonprofit that provides information and assistance for waste management and recycling to more than 400 communities here in New England. And Mike, good to see you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
Also with us, Hannah McCarthy, producer for Outside In, NHPR's show about the natural world and how we use it. And as I said in the latest episode called One Bin to Rule Them All, Hannah looked at the shifting economics of single-stream recycling. And Hannah, it's really fun to have you here. Thank you so much.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, so Hannah, how were you programmed growing up to feel about recycling?
Yeah, I think programming is the right word to use there because I was being taught about recycling in the early 90s. So at that point, you know, the Keep America Beautiful campaign had been around for 30 some odd years at that point. And I mean, I think they call it the Crying Indian ad, the PSA.
I remember that.
Yeah, I think that was still playing when I was a kid. And you see this Native American man, a single tear running down his face at the sight of pollution. And we were taught in school pretty much that there, you know, recycling was a moral obligation to the planet, that we were going to be drowning in trash, but we could save the planet from that fate if we only recycled. And, you know, I watched Captain Planet religiously, and recycling really felt good. I remember when single stream first was introduced in my town, people in the town were genuinely excited, like, oh, this is going to make it that much easier. So I think it's just, it becomes like a visceral reaction to throwing something in the trash versus throwing it in the recycling bin.
And if you've got a little bit of anxiety, you know, Mike, about the health of the planet, yeah, like Hannah said, you feel good. You throw that plastic bottle in, you go, I'm good.
That's what we've done, and we need to do it even more. The predictions back from 1970 when the first Earth Day kicked off, and Hannah's relating how it feels good to save the planet. We need to do that a lot more. There are so many instances now from the plastic gyres that are in the ocean north of Hawaii.
We talked about that on Monday in The Exchange.
There was one before the size of Texas. Now there's two. We pretty much are backing up a garbage truck to the beach every minute and dumping plastic in the ocean. And by 2050, there's going to be more plastic than fish. So it's absolutely imperative that we deal with this head on.
Well, all that plastic you talk about, and we'll cover this in a minute, and yet at a time when a lot of recycling places are saying maybe we can't take glass anymore. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, just getting to what Hannah talked about, you know, the sort of mystique, Mike, or the moral feel-good aspect of recycling.
Well, the theme for our conference this year is recycling rules, and we think that's absolutely the right thing to do. We've got to be able to go to the packaging people and say, look, when you make a package, you've got to have it so there's a closed-loop system, and we're going to be able to reuse that material.
And what does that mean, closed-loop system?
A closed-loop means that whatever you're putting into your system, you're going to be able to reuse or reform or recycle later on as opposed to having to throw it away. And it will reduce the contamination on the single-stream plants, which is what they're facing now, which is driving their costs up, which is why they're having to charge the communities. And as soon as the communities see those bills, that's when the glass has to come out because that weighs a lot.
Okay, so we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, and I definitely want to talk. No, don't apologize. I definitely want to talk about the economics of single-stream, but we should just remind people, Michael, Michael Nork, what recycling was like before single stream?
So before single stream, and actually several communities in New Hampshire still do this, you would actually separate things out. And you'd have what's called source separation, where you take your cardboard, your plastics, your paper, your aluminum cans, everything goes in a separate bin. And the advantage to that system is it maintains the quality of the commodity. So when you have everything separated out, you have very low contamination in those streams, and it maintains the value of those recyclables. What we do nowadays is more common to see single stream, where everything goes in one bin, as Hannah reported about in the Outside In episode. And that has a whole host of issues that kind of compound as a result of everything being mixed together. There's a saying, it's very hard to unscramble an egg once you've scrambled it. You know?
That's a great way to put it, actually. But single stream, right, Michael? I mean, there was a big hope. It would boost recycling rates because it's so easy. You don't have to think about it.
Sure. Yeah, it makes it very convenient for folks. Reduces the amount of trucks that need to go out and pick up recycling, especially if there's a curbside pickup in your community. So there are logistical reasons why it was adopted. However, we're finding that it's causing all sorts of problems with actually marketing the material after the fact, after it's gone through what's called a materials recovery facility, or a MRF, where those items are actually mechanically separated into their constituent parts. So instead of people dropping off their materials at a transfer station like we used to do in the old days, now everything goes in one bin. It goes to a big industrial facility, this MRF, where it's sorted. And it doesn't, it's in most cases, it's not a perfect system. You know, there's a lot of things that still get through. Glass may break and get mixed in with the paper, or vice versa, paper and the glass.
And then it's not clean, it gets contaminated,
exactly.
And it's not as useful.
Exactly.
So before single stream, Mike, who was buying these pristine bins of paper and old plastic milk jugs?
Actually, the same people that are buying them now. For those towns that are still doing source separating versus single stream, they're not having a problem moving their material to market.
Really?
We're actually seeing that we classify it as organically separated material, and the mills that are still in business are preferring to take that material because it doesn't mess up their process. So as Mike said, the explosion of single stream plants nationwide probably went up about 125 plants in about a 5-year period. So we had more and more people moving to single stream and more people putting the material in one bin. And as that happened, the contamination rates took off. So what you would get is, in some cases, a ton of single stream, would 50% of it would have to be thrown away.
Wow, 50% of it.
Because of the contamination. Not just the glass and the plastic, but food waste, all kinds of contaminants that could be put in there that they couldn't process through the single stream plants.
Well, and in her story, Hannah, you talked to Katrina Van Huysen from Eco Maine, a waste to energy plant, and she described to you some of the less than desirable materials that come in from homes who are doing single stream recycling. Let's hear.
We've got a wood pallet. We've got a pillow. We've got a giant thing of styrofoam. We've got a Christmas wreath. You know, these things are not recyclable, and they come to us, and humans pick them out by hand.
So humans pick them out by hand. It slows down the process. As Mike told us, businesses that use recycled materials would much rather have people do it the old-fashioned way. Who would put a pillow in a recycling bin? That makes no sense.
It's a good question, and, Katrina got at this almost immediately during our little tour of the MRF, the materials recycling facility. She called this wishful recycling. So that same feeling that makes you feel so good when you put something in the recycling might lead you to throw something in the recycling rather than put it in the trash, because throwing it in the trash feels kind of bad. And you don't think about the fact that this thing may not be recyclable at all. And so it ends up in the mix. And it's really hard. These MRFs aren't designed to get the trash out. They're designed to separate recyclable material. So people then have to go through and carefully take out all of these things that are not recyclable.
A pillow and a Christmas wreath.
And a lot of food waste as well, I saw.
Yeah, go ahead.
A lot of towns that went single stream also went pay as you throw, which meant it cost you if you put it in the trash. So anything you thought might be recyclable, let's put it over here in this bin, which didn't cost us anything.
Right.
That just increased the contamination rates. And a lot of folks are confused as well by the fact that we've got these three circled arrows going around. Well, it must be recyclable. Not if there's not a market for it. It ends up going in the trash. If you can't sell it or if you can't get it out of the process cleanly, all that material, even though it may look like it can be recycled, is going to end up in trash, sometimes to the, like I say, 50% of the material.
So let me ask, as the innocent consumer, I see that reduce, reuse, recycle logo on a package, Mike, and how am I to know whether it really is recyclable or not? Because I don't think that there are like specifics around that logo, or is it just kind of a wishful
thing? In today's market nationally, you can't. Every MRF that you go to, and Ecomaine is a stellar example of a really good one. They had fantastic education and outreach to the people that participated. So they've got a low residual rate of 7 to 10% of contamination with all that education and outreach that they do. Other plants, like I say, could have as high as 50% contamination that they have to throw out. And it's awfully hard to tell. Some plants can take some things, some take others. Some haven't updated their outreach materials, haven't had time to. Most of the single-stream plants will tell you, we don't want plastic bags. Take the plastic bags back to the grocery that you got them from, because we now have a system with Trex that can take them. If you put them in the bin here, our entire process goes out the window.
Michael Nork, go ahead. I can see you on
Yeah, so I was actually going to touch on the plastic bags as well. That's offender number one. People putting items that are recyclable in plastic bags, or just recycling plastic bags, or plastic bags stuffed with more plastic bags. Big no-no, because it really gums up the mechanical source, the separation systems that these MRFs have. And the other thing is that these MRFs were designed to handle packaging, containers, bottles, paper, cardboard. They weren't designed to handle anything outside that box, so to speak. So anything that's not a consumer packaging item really isn't supposed to go in the recycling bin. There are a lot of things like styrofoam that Katrina mentioned, or plastic film, plastic bags. I've seen people, I live here in Concord, that have been renovating their houses and decided to put their vinyl siding from the house in their recycling bin, thinking that it's plastic, you know, it should be able to get recycled. But again, it's the focus of these systems were designed around what we used to recycle years ago when we dropped everything off. You know, the bottles and cans and paper and cardboard.
So plastic bags, public enemy number one. What about slightly dirty paper plates from a cookout?
Trash.
Yeah.
Trash.
Anything that's food soiled, anything that has food, like oils or grease on it, right. Not great, because if it's going to get mixed in with paper, those greases tend to, you know, contaminate the other paper because it absorbs into the paper. But you can compost it.
Okay, so, and we've used the term MRF a lot, and one of you explained what that is early on, but just remind us, Michael, what's a MRF?
It's a materials recovery facility or materials recycling facility.
Okay.
But it's pretty fun to say MRF.
Well, I want to remind our listeners that you can join us, and then I have so many more questions for all of you about single-stream recycling, the hope, the reality. Join us with your questions and comments. How do they do recycling in your community? What changes have you seen recently? What questions do you have about the economics of recycling, which, as you've probably heard, have been somewhat turned on their head recently by policy decisions as far away as China? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. And Richard's calling from Berlin. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. How are you today?
Fine. Go ahead, Richard.
I was calling because I wanted to bring up something that was going on when I lived in Maine before I lived in New Hampshire, to see if perhaps it could be instituted in New Hampshire. When we were living there, there was an extra 5 cents that was charged on every can, or 10 cents that was charged on every bottle that you bought. And then there were places that you could in turn bring these back to, and they would take them, and you would get the extra nickel or the extra dime back, and in turn all of these materials would then be recycled. And it kind of gave people somewhat of an incentive to be able to recycle these things. And in turn, it got a lot of things out of the trash and a lot of things off the side of the road and things along that line. And as I said, I wondered if perhaps something like that could be instituted in New Hampshire.
Well, Richard, I'm glad you called. And Judy sent us a similar email. She says, do states that have can and bottle redemption program, i.e. 5 cents per can or bottle, experience more sustainable economics from their overall recycling efforts? So I think to you, Mike Durfour, Richard and Judy wanting to know about basically what's been called a bottle tax or a bottle bill.
Bottle bill. New Hampshire is unique in New England. It's the only state that does not have a bottle bill. That was been debated starting back 40 years ago, probably, and it's been debated pretty much on and off every year, every other year. It was interesting that the materials that Richard's talking about, the aluminum cans, the value of those just jumped about 15 cents a pound. So those communities up in his area, we were just speaking with the town of Carroll, they shipped a full load of aluminum cans a couple of years ago, and they got $40,000 for the aluminum cans. So the recycling effort, in absence of a bottle bill, the effort was put into even better recycling. And right now, the latest study I saw from the University of Virginia indicated that the roadsides in New Hampshire are actually cleaner and more litter-free because of the New Hampshire Beautiful Blue Bag program and the fact that we do recycle the aluminum cans without a bottle bill than we see, for example, down on Cape Cod, where they're having a terrible problem with trash and litter on the side of the road, and they have a bottle bill. So we're actually, I think, New Hampshire's doing a much better job of all the six New England states.
That's really interesting to hear. So, Richard, thank you for the call. And let's take another one. This is Ruth in Wilton. Hi, Ruth. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I think that the previous caller may have just already asked my question. But first of all, let me say that I'm a second generation recycler in Wilton. I can't remember how long we've had a recycling center. It's a self-sort kind of thing. It's an easy habit to acquire, and it's a social center. It drives me crazy when I see people with their trash cans along the road, because I think to myself, economically, they're paying for this twice. How stupid. But the main thing I wanted to ask about is litter. I hear parents and teachers sometimes talk about the sustainability issue and how they try to include it across the curriculum. And I ask them about, well, what about litter? And I get blank stares. People don't seem to make the connection between all that stuff that's along the road that you can pick up and recycle. It's an environmental issue. It can all be recycled, and I know we're never going to stop people from throwing that stuff out, but I've been collecting litter for the 14 years that I've lived here.
Well, thank you, Ruth, and a good sentiment as we go into Earth Day weekend. Thank you for the call. You can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or respond on Facebook or Twitter like David did. He sent us a Facebook comment. He says, it's really disturbing to hear that glass is now a problem. Glass was the first widely recycled material, I think. David says, I'd be happy to go back to separating stuff to achieve better recycling results. David, thank you so much, because we're going to pick up on that glass issue after a short break. That has been a big, big deal here in New Hampshire. As some communities say, we're not going to recycle it anymore, as we look more at the economics of single-stream recycling. So all that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I listen to NHPR a lot.
Which is why Scott Brown of Franklin is a sustaining member of NHPR's Leadership Circle.
Trust, dedication, integrity, those are values that I see from top to bottom in NHPR, and we're just proud to be a part of the family.
You too can become a part of NHPR's Leadership Circle when you invest $100 a month into the statewide news service you trust. Join the family at nhpr.org/leadershipcircle.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, one bin to rule them all. That's the title of the latest episode of NHPR's Outside In. You can find a link to that episode on our website. And today, we're looking at what it examined. That's single-stream recycling and how it's affecting the economics of recycling. What's the recycling policy in your town? How have you seen it change? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Mike Durfor is here, Executive Director of the Northeast Resource Recovery Association, which works with communities around New England on waste management and recycling. Hannah McCarthy's here, producer for Outside In, NHPR show about the natural world and how we use it. And Hannah produced the episode that I mentioned, One Bin to Rule Them All, looking at single-stream recycling. Michael Nork's with us, analyst for the Solid Waste Management Bureau at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. So all of you, just before the break, I read a Facebook comment from David asking about glass, saying he would be happy to go back to separating stuff to achieve better recycling results. Hannah, someone in your piece, I can't remember who, said he was aghast when single stream recycling was first introduced. I remember when it was introduced, I said, hooray, I don't have to separate anymore. Why was this person aghast?
That was Richard Bowl. He owns Recycle Midwest in Ohio. It's a recycling facility where everything has to be sorted when it comes into the facility. He told me that, you know, he was shocked when single stream was introduced because essentially it's treating recycling like trash. And he understood that in order to get the best price for something, it had to be perfectly sorted. That, you know, 2-ton bale of cardboard had to be as close to 100% cardboard as possible. And this idea of commingling everything together was going to mean that at some point down the line, there was going to be some kind of crisis. He said he knew immediately when single stream was introduced.
So, and the crisis now is China.
China. That's correct.
Tell us what's going on there, Hannah.
So China has for a while now been implementing various policies to put restrictions on what's coming into their country. We send about a third of our exported recycling to China. So this is something that I had no idea of before I reported this, that we send a lot of our recycling elsewhere. That's how we make money on it. Other countries take it. China implemented a policy called National Sword. And they're now saying that the contamination rate has to be 0.5% at the very highest.
Wow. And Mike told us earlier, in some places in New Hampshire, the contamination rate is 50%. China's not going to like that.
Right. And these MRFs, even the best MRFs, I know that EcoMaine said that they could get their contamination rate in these bales down to about 3-5%. And that's really, really good. So now even EcoMaine isn't able to offload its recycling to China. They're having to find other markets to sell it to, India and other countries.
Well, I definitely want to get our other guests' take on this as well. But in your piece, Hannah, you talked to a couple people who said, single stream, it's, you know, not quite working out the way we had hoped. And NHPR's Rick Ganley, our Morning Edition host, talked to someone about this as well. Wes Anderson, Laconia's Public Works Director. Here he is talking about how policy changes in China, as you mentioned, Hannah, and business decisions elsewhere are all coming together now to affect the recycling program in his city. Let's hear.
China is being one of the big recycling processes. Recently said they don't want anything that's mixed paper, which is basically junk mail and scrap paper. It has too much contamination in it. They said they're not accepting it anymore. The other thing that they did is for their normal material that they still will accept, they reduced the acceptable contamination level from 3% down to 0.5%. The other piece was the cost of transporting it overseas has gone up. And then the last piece, of course, is the only industry in the area that processed recycled glass back into bottles recently closed. So there isn't any place to send the recycled glass at this point.
So, Mike Durfor, a combination of forces, global, local, coming together to make the economics of recycling not as happy as they used to be.
Well, they're much less than happy. Most of the single-stream plants that were built in the last 5 years were built on the basis of the pricing in the marketplace in 2011 when they could get $180 a ton for the material that they sold out the back of the plant. Today, they're being charged that for that material to go anywhere.
So you used to make money, and now you lose money.
If you're making $180 and your processing cost was $100, you had $80 that you had left over. $40 would go to Laconia and $40 would go to the processor.
So everyone's happy.
Everybody was happy in 2011. But once China closed the door, and the Chinese one is a problem that's not going to go away. I'm convinced that it's a very personal issue with the president of China. He made a point of introducing it in April at the meeting before they voted him as president for life. 60% of the groundwater in China is unfit for human consumption.
Wow.
20% of the arable land is contaminated with heavy metals. And they have only 84 out of 340 towns that could meet their air quality standards. They've got a real economic crisis, or environmental crisis, excuse me, going on. And he's taken it personally. Someone showed him a documentary called Plastic China, which showed the life of the Chinese people. And he's taken this on as his own personal cause. So this is not going to change. China takes 30% of the world of our exports, if you will, for recycling goes to China. But the majority of that is coming out of single-stream MRFs. So they're really getting hit hard. Their $180 that they used to get paid, they're actually now getting charged for, as I say, probably about $40 or $50 a ton. So that cost has to get shifted. When that hit everybody's balance sheets, if you will, everybody said, what can we do to save money? Well, what's the heaviest thing in single stream is glass. So everybody said, let's take the glass out. Let's start with that. It's going to help a little bit, but not that much.
So here's the thing that I've always wondered about, this whole recycling economics. And we've been looking at this for a long time here on The Exchange. And I'll throw this to you first, Michael Nork, but anybody jump in. Why do we even send all this stuff to China? I mean, why can't we take the materials? We're smart. We're American, right? You know, we're technologically savvy and innovative. Why can't we take the plastic, the glass, whatever it is, and do creative things with it here? Why do we have to send it halfway across the planet? Never mind all the fossil fuels that are involved in sending it halfway across the planet.
That would be ideal if we could do that. And years ago, we did do that to some degree. There used to be a lot of mills even here in New Hampshire that would take paper and turn it into new products. Unfortunately, the economics have shifted. A lot of those mills are closing. We don't have the capacity here in the United States anymore to really handle those products, partly because our economy has shifted. We're more of a service economy now. We're not so much into the manufacturing. And developing countries like India or China or Vietnam are getting heavier into manufacturing right now. So they have a demand for products that can be used to package the materials and the things that they're making. So part of it is that we just don't have the capacity here to handle it, and there was a demand overseas to take it. So that's kind of what's driven it. And I think now a lot of people are kind of wondering, how can we get more processing capacity here at home?
So could this be a blessing in disguise that China is rejecting so much of our recyclable materials?
Excuse me, Mike.
We do this a lot. the Chinese word for crisis has two parts to it, according to John Kennedy. First is danger, and the second part is opportunity. So we're in the opportunity phase because we can do more with it. As Mike pointed out, Mike Nork did, the mills had already closed because of the pricing that China was able to pay. They were able to command the market. So when those mills went out of business, we lost our domestic capacity. Our real opportunity here, and we're seeing a lot of it coming into play, but it's going to take a year or two to get in place, is to create more domestic capacity for that material to be recycled here in the United States.
So that's the opportunity.
Yes.
So as people sort of pull their hair out and say, oh, no,
don't
recycling
panic.
Isn't economically viable anymore, China doesn't want our stuff, you're saying, let's look at the opportunity in this crisis and come up with our own ways of doing things.
Correct. Let's recycle it right, and then we'll be able to find markets.
I have a lot of people who want to ask you all questions about their own policies in their towns. Here's Tamara in Nashua. I live in a development where garbage pickup is part of my association fees. Recyclables are not included and must be discarded with the trash. Tamara says, why isn't this illegal? Personally, I still separate, she says, pay for a landfill sticker, drive several miles each week to deposit my recyclables, but obviously most people won't. Tamara says, I'm a toxicologist and work in the environment business, so this is particularly disturbing to me. Mike Nork, I guess I'll ask you this, since you work with the Department of Environmental Services. So what is the deal with recycling town by town or city by city? Tamara says, why isn't it illegal that recyclables are thrown out with the trash in Nashua?
Well, New Hampshire doesn't have a mandatory recycling policy statewide. Some other states do. We don't have that. But one of the things that the state, when the state passed its solid waste law back in the early 90s, they included a provision for a solid waste hierarchy, which gives preference to different methods of waste management. Landfilling would be the least preferred, source reduction or, reducing the amount of waste that you actually generate to begin with would be at the top. And then after that would be recycling, composting, waste to energy.
So there's no mandate in New Hampshire.
But there's no mandate.
It's town by town.
It's town by town. And
so she should go to her city council.
Right. Or it sounds like she's in a condo association. Maybe she should bring that up there.
Okay. Well, thank you for the email, Tamara. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email like Tamara did, exchange@nhpr.org. In Newmarket, Alex is calling in. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a thing that's very near and dear to my heart. It's funny because I've noticed that a lot of the people that I work with, the young people, they don't even know the difference between corrugated and paperboard. It's crazy.
So what's your point, Alex, on people's level of understanding?
My point is that our towns need to tell us what we can and can't recycle. I feel like they don't. I mean, maybe if on some obscure part of the town website, you might be able to find what the recycling company that our town uses does and does not recycle. But it's not explicit. It is not comprehensive. It doesn't, like, people want, like, the people I know, they want to recycle. They want to recycle as much as they do. And, like, I heard before, like, wishful recycling, yes. Well, I mean, pillows are ridiculous. But, I mean, I want to recycle as much of the plastic things as I can, but if I'm contaminating stuff, I need to know that.
Well, Alex, thank you for the call. And it's a great point. And, you know, just doing that show, Hannah, on Monday that we did about microplastics, I learned, I think, that plastic straws aren't recyclable. So what did you learn as you went along doing this reporting about just how it can be confusing for people to know what to put in and what not to put in? And so they just throw it all in.
Yeah, education, I think, is paramount here. And I spoke to some recyclers in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has education campaigns ramping up right now, and they have found that in towns where they do implement education campaigns, the recycling rate jumps way up, and the things that are recycled are easier to sort because you're not throwing trash in the recycling bin. A lot of recyclers I spoke to have said, when in doubt, throw it out is their number one recycling
throw
advice.
It out in the trash.
Throw it out in the trash.
Okay.
And that is, you know, that's the first step. But then beyond that, towns, it seems like, really do need to, you know, have billboards and post on the sides of buses and explain to people that recycling is actually a little more difficult than you think it is. It requires more thought than you think it does.
Well, and on the economics of it, Mike, you know, some towns went to pay as you throw. Concord did, where I live. And so there's an personal economic incentive to not do what Hannah said, to when in doubt, throw it in the recycling, because that's free.
Well, we'd say when in doubt, find out. Find out where you're supposed to put it. Find out what you're supposed to do with it. Half of our charter is education and outreach. And as you know, as we've talked, we have people that yesterday were in Hempstead working with third graders to get them into thinking about recycling, not the whole economics necessarily, but the visceral reaction and the gut feeling say, yes, this is what we should be doing. Most of the towns that I know that we work with the transfer stations, they're the front line of information. People come up to them and say, I'm not sure about this. What do I do? And I see it every weekend when I go to my transfer station.
But if you have curbside or single stream like we do in Concord, you don't go to the transfer station anymore and you say, this is great.
It is, but again, find out. You can work with the company that's doing the pickup, and they will provide you with information. They'll put it on the town website, or they'll mail it to their customers.
So if you don't want to be part of the problem that we've talked about, which is people rejecting recyclable materials, it not being an economic win anymore, you need to do that homework and find out.
You do, and in some of the towns, and as Mike indicated, the other states that have a ban on recyclables going to trash, Washington, Oregon, Massachusetts here recently, those states have had to issue waivers to that regulation so that people could throw it in the trash while this crisis is happening until we can get that capacity to take it locally. So it's a real problem that we have to address, certainly. But the education piece, we couldn't stress it anymore. We have monthly meetings. We have a conference coming up in Manchester on May 21st. We have a monthly full of scrap that we send out information on. Anybody that needs information on recycling, they should go to the NRA.net website, quite frankly.
Again, NRRA. Northeast Resource Recovery Association. Alex, I really appreciate the call. You're right. There's a lot of confusion around what to put in and what not to put in. Let's go to Scott in Contoocook. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Laura.
Sure. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, wanted to share, I actually work for a company that's based out of Madison, Wisconsin, EcoStar and Playcon, and we actually recycle 1 billion bottles and thermoforms back into reusable packaging. And what I found as a salesman up and down the East Coast is that a lot of the consumer good companies would rather choose, say, PVC, something that's not as sustainable or even virgin grade, rather than choosing an economic equal, which is rPET.
And why is that?
It really is driven off of just ease and of use and processing. A lot of them think that because they've always used PVC, that the consumer doesn't know the difference. And so it's really up to us to kind of look at the packaging and really reach out to those consumer good companies that don't have a number one label on the actual package itself.
And just remind us what PVC is exactly and you know why it's problematic.
Sure. It's a polyvinyl chloride, so it actually leaches and even outgasses, so it's not as stable as, say, a PET.
And that's problematic because it leaches into landfills? Is that it? Or?
Well, landfills or even the product itself or even the consumer space. So it's something that yellows over time. It's definitely can be a huge challenge.
Wow. Well, Scott, good to hear from you since you're in the business. And Michael, what do you think about some of the comments that Scott makes?
I think Scott made a good point. I think, you know, we talked a little bit about education and the fact that there's really no standardization in recycling systems. But the other end of it is the upstream and what the product, you know, the companies that are making the products and, you know, how they're making them and you know, designing them so that they are actually recyclable and sustainable and using materials that are easily recoverable. So that's a big piece of the puzzle. I think that's something that is not going to happen overnight, but I think more and more, you know, industry representatives are kind of looking into that issue.
So everybody's kind of got a part to play. You as a consumer might want to buy products that come in low impact or recyclable packaging, but if companies are making the choices that Scott tells us about, then what do you do?
There are some encouraging signs. The American Plastics Council is working on just that system with companies like Target and Walmart, where they're going to package it in such a way that the return of the packaging can be used into new material and create a closed loop. And they're signing up what they call plastic champions to do that, and they're going to market that as part of their branding because the most consumers want to deal with companies that are going to create a sustainable future. So there is some encouragement because of this crisis now that people are talking day in, day out, just trying to figure out what can we do with this.
Yeah, I remember when my kids were little, buying them, you know, action figures or whatever, and the those toys, Mike, came in, it must have been like military-grade plastic. I remember having to get out like these huge scissors and knives, and there were many layers, and it was super strong. And I remember thinking, wow, do we really need this much plastic to wrap up this little figure?
We had a great story from Emily Bodecker, who's the commissioner up in Vermont of their environmental conservation group. Her nephews actually wait for the delivery man for their foods to the house, take all the packaging apart, and give it back to the delivery man.
Oh, okay.
So there's
a lot more stories, a lot more information about recycling in just a moment. Stay with us.
NHPR's Leadership Circle is a community of listeners who place a high value on intelligent and independent radio. I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major Gifts at NHPR. As a Leadership Circle sustaining member, your $100 a month investment helps NHPR create and deliver the award-winning news you trust and the outstanding programs you love. If you've been looking to deepen your commitment to the station that's an essential part of your life and your community, join us at nhpr.org/leadershipcircle.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. One bin to rule them all. That's the title of the latest episode of Outside In on NHPR. You can link to that story on our website, and you can join our conversation right now as we look at single-stream recycling, how it has upended the overall economics of recycling. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Hannah McCarthy, Mike Durfour, Michael Nork, so many questions from our listeners. Let's try to get through a few more of them. Here's one from Harrison who says, two questions. We live in a single-stream recycling town. Is it better to drive our recyclables to a manual sort of town if they accept us? And that's a great question, first of all, Harrison. Mike, can you answer that?
There have been a lot of studies on the impact of greenhouse gas measurements, and Mike Nork has done a couple of them. It's awfully hard to separate the trip to the transfer station from the trip to the post office first, because people in my town make it a community gathering kind of thing. It's part of the social fabric. So if we're going to go to the post office anyway and the transfer station's right down the road, probably that's more economical. If you've got 50,000 cars trying to drive one package of recycling to the transfer station, it's not as economical. So it has to be combined.
Environmental.
Exactly.
The environmental aspects of getting in your car and driving, which got to my earlier question about, is it really environmentally sensible to ship all our recycling to China? I mean, again, that's a lot of fossil fuels.
Well, it's no longer an option. So
exactly. There we go.
They closed the door.
So it sounds like, to Harrison's point. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
With Harrison, I would just say maybe do what you can to clean up your recycling.
Your single stream.
What you're producing.
Right.
And that, you know, in aggregate will help, you know, if everyone else does the same thing. Will help that single stream to be cleaner in the end.
So make your single stream better.
Be an
what
example.
You are doing. Don't put the greasy paper plates in like I sometimes do, and I'm not going to do that anymore, I promise. Also, at the break, I wanted to let listeners know, Mike, you were talking about pizza boxes.
Right. So if your pizza box is dirty, only half of it is really dirty. You can rip off the top, and you can put that in the recycling. But if the bottom has oil or grease, you know, you should probably... I would say compost that if you can.
Okay, I am guilty on so many fronts this morning. I'm not even going to go there. But Harrison also says some plastic containers have no triangular recycling number. Are they recyclable with other numbered plastics? Mike, you want to take that one as well?
Yeah, so the question was about the numbering system.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, that system doesn't necessarily mean that something's recyclable. The number actually indicates the resin that's used in the plastic. Number one would be PET, polyethylene terephthalate, which is commonly used for water bottles, you know, the clear plastic. Number two is HDPE. Number three is PVC. Four is LDPE. Five is polypropylene. Six is polystyrene. And seven means other. So it could be anything.
So, you know, for the average person, I'm sitting here listening to you say all those numbers, and I'm thinking, Can't you just say yes or no? I mean,
well, like Mike
that's
said
really
before,
confusing.
Mike Durfour said before, it depends on whether there's actually a steady market for that material. That's what really dictates whether something's recyclable or not. And generally speaking, ones and twos have a very stable market. So those are the things that are most commonly recycled. Three through sevens are much less consistent. And those are the things that we were typically shipping over to China. The 3 through 7 stream, and now they don't want that at all because it's problematic. There's not really, really good end uses for those materials because they're really inconsistent.
Mike, I think most people don't even look at the numbers. They see the recycling logo and they go, okay, boom.
It probably technically can be recycled at some point, but at what cost, and is there a market?
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Harrison. And Neil is in Manchester calling in. Hi, Neil. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A question I've been wondering throughout this entire section is kind of what's the difference between municipalities that are like proactive about creating initiatives? Like, I know some municipalities install like compost bins for households to use and like educate them on how to navigate that. And some municipalities kind of lead the drive in kind of encouraging folks to have reusable bags, avoid straws, things like that. So is it kind of just like trash is profitable and like what kind of separates New Hampshire from the rest of the states that are kind of like leading that drive?
Well, and thank you for the call, Neil. And Mike Durfour, you work around New England, so mm-hmm. Let's hear from you on that one.
I think this is a great lead into the next crisis that's coming, and that is a crisis in trash capacity, which we don't have in New England, which is going to drive the economics of the trash. Right now, everybody's looking at their single stream bill and saying, if I'm paying $140 a ton for single stream and I'm only paying $65 or $70 a ton for trash, maybe all that should go in the trash, economically speaking. But what's going to happen is the trash number is going to get overloaded and it's going to ramp up, and we're going to have a 5 million ton shortfall in New England by 2025. And we're going to end up shipping our trash to Ohio or to Pennsylvania or to Virginia, and it's going to cost more than the 75 it does now. So once everybody has changed over, then they're going to get a bigger bill from the trash side of it. The best way to deal with that, and I think the caller's great point, is to deal with it at the source. The more composting we can do, the more we take it out of both the trash and the contamination of the single stream, so it's a win-win. And DES, I know, is leading the effort to try and encourage more composting in New Hampshire in advance of this tsunami of capacity loss that we're going to have.
Well, and in fact, I think, Michael, you joined us for a composting show a couple months ago, so
that's
there
right.
is that. And just listening to Mike, Hannah, talk about, you know, shipping our trash to Ohio, whatever, it kind of conjures up those images that you talked about in the beginning, like the garbage barge in New York and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was shocking for me to learn is that there are landfills in this country that have plenty of capacity. You know, even though it will cost more money for us to ship it elsewhere, it can go into the landfill. I think the element that's going to prevent that from happening is the fact that people do, in fact, want to recycle. We still have that programmed desire to do so.
In our heads. And did people talk to you in your story, Hannah, about, you know, the potential for landfills, like waste to energy and making better use of these?
Yeah. So actually, EcoMaine has a waste to energy plant. It's huge and very impressive. I watched many, many tons of garbage slowly falling into a massive incinerator. And they managed to power their entire plant, as well as their electric car and 15,000 homes in Portland with the energy that they produce burning that waste. And so the only thing that they landfill is the ash from that burnt waste. And then they're also trying to figure out what to do with that ash. Can they build homes out of it? They're not sure yet what, you know, whether it leaches anything. But there are arguments against it, you know, emissions arguments, and many people think that it would decrease recycling rates. But there are studies that show that, you know, with new technology, the emission rates are negligible and that it doesn't necessarily decrease recycling. So there are arguments certainly for waste energy.
Well, and let's pick up on that. I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but getting creative. I mean, given the crisis, which is also an opportunity, as you said, Mike, with China no longer wanting our recycled junk, what do you see around you, Michael Nork, in terms of innovation around trash and recycling and so forth?
So regrettably, here in New Hampshire, we have been focusing most of our attention on, you know, that solid waste hierarchy that I mentioned earlier, and landfilling being the lowest preference on that hierarchy. Unfortunately, we've been spending most of our time looking at that issue and permitting facilities that will be landfilling material. The state would certainly welcome any proposals that, you know, advance things higher on the hierarchy, like waste to energy. The problem with waste to energy is that there are issues also not just with emissions, but also with power purchase agreements and the cost, you know, the price of electricity that kind of help the economics of making those facilities sustainable. And there's also, you know, other opportunities to, you know, advance things even higher on the hierarchy, like more recycling capacity locally. You know, I heard at a talk recently about the ability, there's a new technology being proposed to take plastics and use them for a feedstock for 3D printing. So that's something that could be done locally and, you know, handle plastics in a, you know, a kind of a closed loop system here at home rather than having to ship it thousands of miles.
Yeah, which just seems kind of crazy. So
yeah.
So when you get permit requests for new ways to deal with or new facilities to deal with our leftovers, whatever you want to call them, recyclables, trash, you're getting more requests for approval for landfills than for new recycling centers or waste energy plants.
Right, right.
We're just keep doing it the old-fashioned way, basically.
So, unfortunately, the department has not had the resources to really kind of get out in front of this and lead the charge on recycling. We just don't have the staff to do that. So we have been kind of responding to what the market has been asking for, and the market has been asking for landfills.
Well, and
but
here,
we want to see
yeah.
more innovation. We want to see more opportunities to recover resources and do things that are higher and better use of materials.
Here's an email from Gary that I really want to read. So Gary, thank you so much. He says, I have yet to hear your guests talk about creating the demand for recycled materials. We, the consumers, need to be thinking of our purchases in terms of buying products that have post-consumer materials. Purchasing toilet paper, paper towels, copy paper, materials made with post-consumer content is key to making a closed-loop system a reality. Gary says we need to mimic nature with our consumption habits. So, Mike Durfor, we've talked about these terms throughout the show, but we should just remind people. So what does that mean, post-consumer, and what's the importance of that closed loop?
If we knew we had a market for glass right now, we could ship all the glass that we collect to that market, but we don't. That's the used glass is post-consumer. The consumers used it. Now we've got to find a final destination, if you will. The ideal destination would be to make it into more glass, or as we do in our program at NRA, the PGA program, we actually collect the glass bottles. So it's not in the single stream. It's not in the trash. We then crush it up, and in the towns like New London, where Richard Lee is the DPW director, he uses 100% of that under sidewalks and roadbed and in parking lots, that type of thing. So the glass is all being reused.
And locally.
And by the time you get done with it, it's sand. It starts as sand. It ends up as sand. That's a nice closed loop. The challenge is finding enough people that are willing to use it because they haven't had experience with it or they haven't heard that it's viable. The call is absolutely right. And the more we can do it, and that's where the American Plastics Council champion would come in, was, okay, this is how we're going to package this product, and we're going to be able to take that packaging and reuse it. We're designing that system up front to make sure it is a closed loop and it doesn't end up in the trash.
Well, and here's an email from someone who didn't give a name. I'm trying to convince our town to use glass for road work. You mentioned sidewalks, Mike. But I've been told that New Hampshire DOT only allows 20% glass aggregate. I've been told that it costs more to mix it with gravel than just to buy gravel. Can you discuss? Do you know about this?
Just a little bit. We've been in touch with DOT for the last 2 years trying to get them to up the percentage. I talked to Dennis Bovaire from DOT Specs only 2 weeks ago. The 20% rule is for private construction. The regulations that certified glass as a certified waste-derived product allow communities to use it up to 100% if they want. The municipalities in municipal projects, and Richard Lee's done this time and time again, especially under sidewalks. And it's really preferred to bank run gravel because it's much more frost resistant. The water will flow through the glass much easier once it's been ground up. So it's actually more economical, and it's a reuse of the material. It's a perfect application for it. You can use it at 100% if they want in town projects.
Well, and a lot of people we've heard from are upset that their towns are not taking glass anymore. And again, there's the economics and the environmental costs of shipping stuff all the way to China. So there's a solution right there. But it seems like there's some hesitancy in that being adopted.
The hesitancy is just the requirement that you have to have a certified engineer stamp on the use of the material. The material's been tested by the City of Keene. It's been tested by the Cold Research Center north of Hanover, and it passes all the DOT specs for use. It's just a matter of committing people to saying, yes, I will take all the glass you collect before we collect a lot of glass and we have a pile of glass type of thing. We're also working with a firm up in Canada, again, within the last 2 weeks, that would prefer to take the cullet uncrushed glass as is and truck it to Canada, and they're going to process it and use it for fiberglass. So we're trying to explore all the options that we can find a solution for that glass.
Not quite as far away as China, so
correct.
That's good. All right, let's take another call. And Lena's in Portsmouth. Hi, Lena. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. This is with innovation. You talk about new ideas. And I'm an old Swede, and I really I have that visceral feeling about what you're doing with your waste here. So I just wanted to tell you, it varies in the communities depending how large they are. Sometimes they have just collection stations through the city. You can put all your metal cans, the paper, and different things in containers, and some places, they have a huge place. It seems like it's a meeting place in town.
This is in and Sweden you're talking about, Lena, right?
Huh?
You're talking about New Hampshire or Sweden? In Sweden.
Sweden.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
Just innovation for the future. So it's they're very specific, you know. It's clear glass, brown glass, green glass. They're very specific, and everyone walk around and put the things in the right container, and it's just a part of the culture, and it just seemed good.
Well, and Lena, I'm so glad you called, because, you know, Mike, this is how, up until single stream was introduced, this is how it was done in New Hampshire. People went to the dump, they separated their stuff. They get together and chat. How you doing? Right? I mean, this is what it used to be like, what, 25
right.
years ago in New Hampshire, or even 20
right.
years ago.
And there still are towns that do it, and they're faring okay. I think the push for single stream was kind of it was driven by economics. It was driven by, you know, this idea of consolidating material and really kind of, you know, it was something that seemed like a good idea. It seemed like it was on the cutting edge, and it would also make recycling easier for people. Unfortunately, we are seeing these problems, and I know glass has been a really hot button issue.
Oh yeah.
And what Mike was talking about with using glass as an aggregate for road base or, you know, subsurface, you know, the aggregate, it's that's the exact kind of thing that, you know, I was talking about in terms of finding ways to reuse and recover resources locally, and the state did approve process glass aggregate PGA as a certified waste-derived product back in 1999. Maybe it's time to revisit that and kind of get the word out a little bit more about that it is an option, and that, you know, to create more awareness about it.
Well, all of you, I can't believe it. We've run out of time. I had a lot more I could have asked you, but I really appreciate being here. Hannah, thank you so much for helping us out today.
Of course,
appreciate
Laura.
It. That's Hannah McCarthy, producer for Outside In. In the latest episode called One Bin to Rule Them All, Hannah looked at the shifting economics of single-stream recycling. You can find a link to that on our website. And Mike Durfour, really good to see you.
Thank you very much.
That's Mike Durfour, Executive Director of the Northeast Resource Recovery Association. And Michael Nork, thank you also for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
Michael Nork, Analyst for the Solid Waste Management Bureau at New Hampshire DES. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.